This is a podcast of the Political Ecology Forum at Norwegian University of Life Sciences. Visit politicalecology.space.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Political Ecology Forum podcast at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. I am Noé Mendoza. I'm a PhD candidate here at NMBU at the department called Nora Greek. And today we have a special guest. We have with us Dara Sands. Welcome, Dara, to the podcast.
Thanks.
Dara, he's also a PhD candidate at the Institute at Nora Greek at NMBU. And today we invited him to have a conversation around an article that he recently published. The title of the article is "The Wilding Wolfland: Exploring the Historical Dimensions of Human-Wildlife Conflict and Coexistence in Ireland." This article was published in Conservation and Society this year in summer, I believe. And so welcome, Dara. Thanks for being here. I would like to begin this conversation asking you if could you share with us a bit about the overarching goals of your PhD project and how does the article "The Wilding Wolfland" fits in?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the invitation to the podcast, Noé. So originally, the main focus of my PhD research, which began a long time ago, back in September 2017, was on examining this idea of rewilding through the lens of environmental justice. Over time, during the research design process, I decided to shift the focus slightly away from environmental justice and more towards this idea of coexistence and how conflicts that are associated with rewilding might be positively transformed in a manner that can help support long-term coexistence between people and wildlife in shared landscapes and shared spaces. So very briefly, maybe some of your listeners are unfamiliar with rewilding, what it is. So first of all, there's a variety of different ideas and practices and concepts associated with rewilding. Essentially, and without using too much jargon, which is often part of rewilding definitions, it's a conservation / land management strategy that aims to essentially afford more space to nature. So one way that rewilding proponents aim to do this is by restoring certain animals or keystone species who are understood to play important ecological roles in ecosystems. So this approach, which is typically called trophic rewilding, there's one well-known example, which is the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park in the United States in the mid-1990s. So the claim around this reintroduction is that the wolves returned. It helped to change the entire Yellowstone ecosystem in a positive way. And it's often cited by rewilding advocates as an example of the important role that keystone species can play, such as wolves, in regulating or bringing balance to ecosystems. There's some recent studies that have suggested that this story of the wolf's return is a little bit more complicated and it's a bit of a myth, and that the wolf's impact on the Yellowstone landscape has been somewhat exaggerated. Anyway, linking back to my article, which is the first article of my PhD, one of the reasons why I chose to focus on wolves is because they've become this symbol of rewilding, of wildness, and they have a prominent position in the rewilding discourse, and because similar arguments are being used now and mobilized to promote their reintroduction to Ireland in terms of this idea that if wolves are brought back to Ireland, it can help to control deer numbers, which are perceived to be, which actually have been increasing quite a lot, and that wolves can bring this sense of balance back to Irish ecosystems. However, I noticed within the rewilding debates in Ireland, they often focus on these different pros and cons of bringing back certain species, but often overlooked is the reasons why these species were eradicated in the first place. You know, what led to places being dewilded in the past tends to be overlooked. Rewilding is often sort of framed and promoted in a very positive way, that it's an optimistic and hopeful approach to conservation. So maybe that's why there's slightly less focus on this kind of on these historical reasons why species were lost. So when these reasons are addressed, they tend to be addressed in terms of quite general or vague statements, such as human persecution was the cause of, you know, wolves being eradicated from Ireland, or, you know, habitat loss or things like this, you know, which tends to obscure maybe the root causes that have led to the loss of species in the past. So the aim of my article then was to explore these kind of deeper historical dimensions of rewilding in more detail by both focusing on the conflicts in the past that led to wolves being eradicated, but also looking at how past societies were able to live with wolves and to coexist with wolves. So that's where the coexistence idea comes into play in the first article.
So the article, in a way, I think it's trying to contribute to a debate taking place developing in Ireland nowadays. Could you introduce us a little bit? You already mentioned some elements, but in this debate about rewilding in contemporary Ireland, which actors are involved in this debate and what are the main arguments from the different positions?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I can try to provide an overview of the rewilding debate in Ireland at the moment. It's quite difficult to characterize, though, because obviously there's many different actors involved, and the debate, they tend to interpret rewilding in slightly different ways. You know, to borrow Paul Voosten's phrase for the Anthropocene, rewilding tends to be an argument that's wrapped in a word these days. You know, there's different actors of quite extreme views on what rewilding is. For example, some proponents of rewilding, they view it as a solution for addressing, you know, a wide range of environmental problems, such as habitat degradation, for example, species loss, climate change, to name a few. So one of the issues is that these problems tend to be attributed to agricultural practices, which leads to tensions between advocates of rewilding and farming interests. And this has led to some resistance from the agricultural sector, which tends to be based on this perception of rewilding that opposes a threat to farming and to rural communities. And there's actually some evidence, I think, that supports these concerns in Ireland. For example, one of the most high-profile rewilding projects is the privately owned Dunsany Nature Reserve in County Meath. So it's part of Rewilding Europe's European Rewilding Network. European Rewilding are kind of the most prominent rewilding organisation in Europe currently. So Dunsany Nature Reserve, this was once farmland, but all the animal agriculture has been removed from the farmland and it's now been kind of transformed into this wild space. And the idea here is that by removing, you know, animal agriculture, it's reverting to a more natural and wilder state. And the project has received considerable media coverage, and it possibly reinforces this view that certain human activities, such as livestock grazing, are incompatible or they're not part of rewilding. But on the other hand, there's examples of rewilding initiatives in Ireland, like the White-tailed Seagull Project in County Kerry, the Golden Eagle Project in County Donegal. These projects have been conceived on the basis that livestock farming constitutes an important element of rural landscapes in Ireland. So rather than attempt to remove livestock from the areas where these species have been reintroduced, the Golden Eagle Trust, who've been one of the sort of the leading actors involved in these projects, they've worked hard to build positive relationships and partnerships with hill farming organisations and local communities, Irish speaking communities, for example, because they recognise that, you know, local support is quite essential for building coexistence. It's also, I think, quite important to stress that although the rewilding debate is typically framed as being mainly about these tensions between rewilding and farming, it's quite a binary framing. It's also important to consider the implications of rewilding in relation to other land uses, which are becoming more prominent, such as renewable energy developments, for example. So the governments in the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland currently have this commitment to increase renewable energy production considerably by 2030. And this is something that I explore in the second article of my PhD, which is looking at the case of the Red Kite Reintroduction Project in County Down. So I won't go into more detail about that now. But
upcoming conversation.
Yeah.
There says, and some part in the article, you explain or mention the concept of the triple win, which I understood as being behind the argumentation for rewilding. What would be those wins, if you could explain a bit, in the case of the wolf coexistent objective in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, I think People familiar with conservation and development discourses will be familiar with this idea of win-win solutions, triple win solutions that are often associated with particular projects as a way to essentially to sell them. So when it comes to rewilding, for example, when it was first devised in the United States, it was presented as an opportunity for recovering important wildlife populations and creating core areas and corridors to support these populations. So it was a win in terms of biodiversity conservation, in terms of, you know, environmental benefits. In Europe, rewilding has also been promoted as being beneficial to local economies and local communities, so primarily through wildlife and nature-related tourism. So the idea here is that rural land abandonment and the decline of small-scale farming in Europe, this is inevitable, and rewilding then it represents an opportunity by creating new livelihoods. According to Rewilding Europe, for example, this is a way to unlock the commercial value of natural capital in these rural landscapes that rural communities are unaware of this value, apparently. So in addition to these claimed benefits to biodiversity and local economies, rewilding is also promoted as a nature-based solution for addressing climate change by restoring ecosystems and allowing wildlife populations to recover, who can play an important role, for example, in carbon sequestration. In the case of wolf reintroduction to Ireland, similar arguments are also used to promote their return. So some have also suggested that reintroducing wolves to Ireland would represent an act of decolonization due to the reasons that maybe we'll discuss a bit later that led to the demise of wolves in Ireland. And these similar, in addition to these, you know, arguments based on environmental benefits, economic benefits, climate benefits, similar kind of ethical based arguments are also used to support the idea of bringing back species that have been wiped out in the past, because it's a means to right the wrongs of the past, essentially, that there's a responsibility to, you know, make up for the errors of the past by bringing back species that we've wiped out. So there's quite a few different arguments that are mobilized in support of rewilding and wolf reintroduction specifically.
Interesting. And well, the article deals with long-term or long-durée history. What motivated you to adopt such an approach, the long-durée approach, in your inquiry on wolf-human coexistence?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons why I decided to adopt this approach. First of all, the term rewilding, it implies that at some point in the past, in certain places in the world at least, that the world was more wild, and it's desirable to make the present, the future, wild again. However, as I previously mentioned, the sort of the underlying causes and drivers that led to places becoming less wild or de-wilded, as I put it in the article, they're rarely addressed by rewilding advocates, even though that's what my article is attempting to do, to highlight these roots that reach back to the past in terms of these dewilding processes. So I think it was necessary in a way that this was a beneficial approach for examining and understanding these past processes, adopting this long-durée approach, which, it is quite a difficult approach, I think, in practice, in order to sort of define the historical period that I was going to focus on the paper. Initially, my idea was to focus on the early modern period, this period of conflict, you know, this period that led to the wolf's eradication from Ireland. But because the focus of the paper was also on coexistence, and I thought it was, you know, necessary essentially to highlight that prior to this period of conflict, there was also an extended period of coexistence. So in the present, for example, human-wolf relations are often framed, human-wildlife interactions, for example, they're often framed in terms of conflict. So there has been a shift more towards looking at sort of the complexity of human-wildlife interactions and looking more at how at different examples of coexistence, of how people have lived with wildlife and how people are doing that in certain places in the world at the moment. So that's why I adopted this longer perspective to try to zoom in on this period of coexistence. But again, attempting to cover a 10,000 year period is quite difficult in the space of a short article.
I myself, I'm working with in one of my articles with long-term history or long-durée approach. And yeah, I can see that sometimes, for me at least, the task seems seemed a bit daunting because it's that there's so much information out there, and in the end, it's put in words in a few pages. And yeah, that I perceived while reading your article. Now, I would like to move towards the policy implications, because I think your article hints at many directions of where the debate could move on. For example, do you see any cultural beliefs, practices, or attitudes from the past that could be reinvented to promote a fair rewilding policy in contemporary Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, I think one insight from the article, was quite interesting was sort of different cultural beliefs associated with wolves in Ireland in the past that were based on animist beliefs and supernatural beliefs and sort of more spiritual beliefs. So, you know, I think in this regard that the storytelling can play an important role in terms of trying to re-establish some cultural connections between modern-day Ireland and past cultural beliefs related to wolves. So, for example, there was an animated film called Wolf Walkers about the last wolves in Ireland that was inspired by Irish folklore and stories about humans shape-shifting into the form of wolves, for example, that was well-received. And I think, you know, drawing on these cultural beliefs and practices from the past in a way can maybe help to promote the sense that the wolf had once belonged in Ireland, and perhaps in the future it can belong in Ireland, can sort of regain a place in the Irish landscape. But at the same time, there's also some practices that I sort of very briefly touch on the paper that I think are maybe relevant when it comes to the question of wolf reintroduction in Ireland. For example, like, it's quite clear that in the past that wolves were hunted for various reasons, and I think that this would maybe need to be considered as a possible management option in the present if wolves are brought back. For example, to deal with so-called problem wolves that create problems for livestock. But again, I think this would be very controversial, and I'm not sure it would be accepted by rewilding supporters that wolves are brought back and then there's a possibility
in order to be hunting them.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another, I very briefly mentioned the example of the use of livestock guardian dogs, which were used to protect, sheep and cattle, primarily sheep, from wolves and other predators. And there's many examples of guardian animals being used this way in the present in places where people live alongside wolves. That is a possible approach that could be applied in Ireland. However, again, I think it would be controversial in terms of, for animal welfare issues regarding the use of dogs in this way. I mean, people love dogs. There's a potential for dogs to be, killed by wolves. So, there's some, ethical issues that would need to be considered there.
Is it so that in Ireland, could you generalize that wolves have in general bad publicity, bad press?
I'm not necessarily sure if that's the case. I think there's a lot of positivity towards wolves, especially in recent times, where their reputation, I suppose, has been reinvented, as a result of situations like in Yellowstone, where they've been portrayed as, these very important keystone species, as having these multiple sort of beneficial environmental effects. But at the same time, I think a lot of the contemporary understanding of wolves it's not based on direct practical experience of living with wolves. It's based on, examples from other contexts, mm-hmm. and then they're then used to argue for the reintroduction of wolves into Ireland. So, for example, some proponents of wolf reintroduction in Ireland, they argue that, wolves are not dangerous animals, that there'd be no threat to people. Studies have shown that there's a very, very small risk to people from wolves. But at the same time, when it comes to having a public discussion about wolf reintroduction, it's essential that this is, guided by evidence, and there is some evidence of wolf attacks on people and children. So, this needs to be part of the debate and, part of the discussion about bringing back an animal that can potentially be dangerous. You know, also in relation to, you know, your question, which is about how to promote fair rewilding policies, I think it's also important to consider what this means in relation to sort of the non-human actors that are at the center of rewilding projects. I mean, we're talking about, you know, bringing back wolves. You know, I think there's quite a high chance that, you know, wolves would be, you know, targeted by certain people. I mean, there's quite a considerable problem with wildlife crime in Ireland at the moment. You know, the reintroduction projects that I've mentioned already, the white-tailed seagull project, the red kite project, the golden eagle project. There have been some instances where these birds have been killed. And it's very, very difficult to deal with that problem, essentially. So I think that would be an issue when it comes to bringing back wolves. For instance, there's also an opinion piece about introducing beavers to Ireland, which appeared in the Irish media last week, which presented, you know, beavers, which were, there's no evidence that they were ever native in Ireland currently. But the idea is that, you know, if they're brought back, they'll act as ecological saviours, that, you know, they're going to help to improve habitats. So, I mean, again, these projects are promoted on the basis that these animals will play an important role for people. They're essentially, you know, a form of nature-based solution. Under the article, there was a comment about, well, you know, if it doesn't work out with reintroduction, we can always just eliminate the beavers, you know, so the value of these animals is essentially reduced to their contribution to people. And if they don't fulfill the role, you know, they're expected to fulfill, then, you know, it's just a quite, you know, it's very simple to wipe them out, essentially. So, yeah, I think that requires further discussion as well.
But I think your article shows also that beyond like the functional argument, let's say, of that could be behind the triple wins, there's this historical and cultural heritage then in a way. When reading the story of human wolf coexistence and its eventual de-wildingization, I got the impression that human wolf coexistence is a sort of lost world if we think of Ireland today. My question is, isn't there a risk of turning rewilding policies into a new form of exclusion for example, farmers or other actors of Irish society that may no longer aspire to recreate that lost world? And how to avoid such a risk?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to rewilding and coexistence being a lost world in Ireland, I think that is a fair point. I think there are sort of clues in the landscape about the sort of hint towards how people coexisted with wildlife in the past. For example, you know, place names linked to eagles and wolves, for example, you know, they provide these clues that once, you know, wildlife were culturally significant, and, you know, to the extent that places were named after them. But at the same time, I think it can be problematic to put too much emphasis on these past relationships, you know, to the point where, you know, it risks overlooking the implications in the present of bringing back species and, you know, rewilding policies in the present. So I think this is where, you know, perspectives from political ecology, from environmental justice are particularly relevant, you know, for challenging these apolitical, ahistorical approaches to rewilding that, you know, overlook its potential for excluding people, particularly, you know, people who are living and working in the rural areas, which are, you know, tend to be the areas that are most commonly targeted for rewilding. Rewilding is sometimes discussed in the context of urban areas, but in Ireland, it's primarily, you know, these rural spaces, uplands, for example, that are, you know, presented as being degraded, that are areas that, you know, should be rewilded in terms of to restore these areas to how they should look to a more wild state, or that's your argument. So, I mean, in terms of how this risk could be avoided, you know, of rewilding, essentially, you know, reproducing these exclusionary practices, which, you know, political ecology has done a very good job of highlighting, you know, are often associated with conservation. You know, maybe it sounds a bit formulaic, but, you know, attempting to ensure rewilding policies, you know, they're developed in partnership with the communities who will actually, you know, benefit from rewilding and bear the costs of rewilding. I think that's quite fundamental. This, of course, is not always easy to do in practice. the white-tailed seagull reintroduction project, for example, in County Kerry. You know, the project managers, they attempted to include the Farming Association on the steering group, but they were unwilling to do that because they were concerned about how the return of these birds would impact their livestock, would impact, you know, proposals for wind farms on their land, for example. So they were unwilling to get involved with the project in that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, participation, partnership building, you know, they're often presented as, you know, solutions for advancing more, you know, just and inclusive forms of conservation. Mm-hmm. In practice, it can be quite difficult to implement such approaches. You know, if we're talking about bringing back wolves and you know, raptor birds and other wildlife that have the potential to impact on wildlife, then I think it's quite important to ensure that there is funding available to compensate landowners for damage inflicted to their wildlife. And in general, I think just avoiding, you know, top-down approaches that don't consider the livelihood needs, the well-being of local communities, may also help to avoid, you know, such risks in the future. One point I wanted to make, though, in relation to, you know, my second article and the third article in particular, when it comes to the people I've actually interviewed for my PhD about rewilding, you know, my expectation going into the field was that, you know, people would be very negative towards rewilding, that they would oppose this idea. And that was primarily informed by, you know, what I've read about rewilding in the media. However, you know, people were generally, you know, I was talking about interviewing farmers, landowners around County Down in Northern Ireland, and they were generally, you know, positive, curious about rewilding was. You know, their main concerns, however, they were related to conservation policies, proposing further environmental designations, you know, creating more protected areas, which were viewed very negatively because they put certain restrictions on how private landowners can, you know, use their land. So, for example, the European Union's Habitats Directive, whenever it was implemented in Ireland in the 1990s and early 2000s, you know, it led to the designation of conservation areas on private land, which put restrictions on what people could do. It led to more regulations. It was quite fiercely resisted. Sort of, there's been a lot of, as a result of that, there's been some bitterness and some sort of, there's been issues with, you know, the legitimacy and trust towards conservation institutions. What's happening now in Ireland is that there are proposals for more designations, which are linked to this idea of, you know, 30 by 30, setting aside 30% of the earth by 2030 as protected areas. And, you know, again, just based on the interviews I've conducted, I think this is more likely to lead to conflicts, possibly, than rewilding will. But rewilding is obviously part of this discourse because it's an idea that's kind of underpinning, you know, proposals for area-based conservation, for increasing the amount of protected areas, this idea of setting aside core areas for conservation, trying to connect them. I mean, these are kind of the founding ideas of rewilding.
Yeah, interesting. So then it's we should never fall in the trap of assuming that the positions will be black and white out there, I guess. And towards the end of the article, there is a hint of a link between the aim to decolonize our institutions and the bioculturally diverse futures. Do you see a link between decolonization and biodiversity?
Yeah, I think between decolonization and biodiversity conservation, yeah, for sure. I mean, the third article of my PhD, which is looking at rewilding through the lens of this idea of convivial conservation. And convivial conservation is very much guided by an ethic of decolonization. It aims to promote, you know, post-capitalist alternatives to existing approaches to conservation, which I think is a very useful framework in relation to how conservation is practiced in Ireland at the moment. You know, as I mentioned, the existing conservation institutions in Ireland, particularly state institutions and certain NGOs, you know, the way they approach the practice of conservation is, it's been described as by one researcher as remarkably undemocratic. As I mentioned, you know, they tend to favour top-down approaches. But at the same time, the reason why these conservation institutions tend to favour such approaches is because, they tend to be severely under-resourced, underfunded. I mean, in Northern Ireland, for example, the agency responsible for conservation is also part of the agency responsible for agriculture and rural affairs, and the conservation tends to be a lower priority. So it's very difficult then when it comes to implementing, you know, global conservation policies, EU conservation policies at a local level, the resources aren't necessarily there to do that, you know, in a fair and just way. So, I mean, I think that opens up the question of, you know, it's important then to explore alternative possibilities in terms of how conservation is practiced, you know, beyond, you know, designations, or if designations are going to be pursued, you know, how this can be done in a more fair way. Yeah, but again, this is something that, you know, I discuss more in the third article. The third article, I also look at how, you know, as a result of the general ineffectiveness of, you know, environmental governance institutions, conservation institutions in Ireland, there's been a growing grassroots movement involving local communities who are basically taking responsibility for protecting, you know, the places and areas that they care about, you know, resisting extractive industries and various other practices that they see as harmful, you know, to their places. So that's an interesting kind of a dynamic, you know, in response to the failures of the state to, you know, carry out their role in protecting, you know, natural and cultural heritage, that, you know, individuals, community groups are taking on that role instead. But again, this is something I go into in more detail by looking at sort of rewilding, convivial conservation, and these alternative environmental movements in Ireland in the third article.
Great. No, I think it's a very interesting debate, and we hopefully will have an opportunity to keep this conversation as the next articles come. Okay, so we are out of time. I want to close this interview by inviting the audience to get a hold of the article. They can find it in the internet. As I read the title in the beginning, is "The Wilding Wolf Land: Exploring the Historical Dimensions of Human Wildlife Conflict and Coexistence in Ireland" by Dara Sands. So yeah, I invite you to take a look and engage in this debate of rewilding in Ireland and also in other parts of the world. I think it's a very hot issue out there. So thank you, Dara, again.
Thanks
for sharing a bit of your work. And keep following us on Spotify and other platforms. This was the Political Ecology Forum podcast at NMBU.